This is the Icon Podcast, a community of trained readers reflecting Jesus with Michael Burns and Jason Alexander. I'm your host, Gian Hearn. So the gang is back together. We're continuing New Creation. Woot woot. That's what Michael's doing. Putting two things up. Jason is alive and present here. He's fixing his Milwaukee Bucks cap. I feel like this is going to be a good show, guys.
That's a nice hat. Can we talk about that for a minute?
Is it?
That is a top quality Bucks hat.
All right, yeah. Well, it's the right team.
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
According to you two, yes.
I'm a little irritated with them right now, but we don't need to go into all that.
I know.
But we're actually kind of talking fashion today. We were just talking, Gianna, about how much you're digging sweatpants and your vast array of sweatpants in your wardrobe currently.
Well, it's more like jogger style, but athletic leisure wear has now become professional wear. So that's what I'm rocking nowadays on TV in the middle of a broadcast. I tend to go for the leathers, what we're talking about. I'm not sure all of my coworkers like it, but guess what? It's comfy. So just like Jason said earlier, I'm glad that's the era that we're in right now, that type of fashion era.
Yeah. You know, go ahead, Jason.
I was going to say I've never had leather pants. I'm almost positive I couldn't make that work.
I almost agree. Didn't want to tell you that, but there's very few men I feel like can pull that look off. To be honest, Reggie couldn't do it. Michael couldn't do it. I don't think you could
like
do
Axl Rose, Brett Michaels, someone like
that. What do you mean I couldn't do it confidently, like just with no question in your mind?
Okay, maybe it depends on what look you're going for. But if you're looking for that like biker chic look, like you might be able to pull it off. But if you're looking at it in the way that I tend to showcase it, which is like cool, funky, like hip hop culture, I don't think you would get the same vibe if you wore it that way. And I'm not trying to be judgmental here. We might need to move on because this could be.
Wasn't there an episode of The Office where somebody put on leather pants and then couldn't get them off?
That sounds about right.
Am I thinking of, or was it Friends? No, it was Friends.
Oh, I haven't watched either one.
It was the dude Ross.
Okay, and they were stuck on him?
Yeah, he couldn't get him off or something, and that was like
No, I know what you're talking about. It's Seinfeld, and Kramer puts on some tight jeans.
Oh, is that what it was?
And he can't get him off. Yeah, that's what you're thinking of.
Okay.
Unless there's another one.
I think there might wear him be for like an episode of Friends with leather pants. I think there might be.
Wow.
But no, speaking of fashion, do you know what store I went to for the first time in my life this past weekend?
Let's guess.
It's high fashion with the young folks now.
Yeah, I'm like, I don't even know where to go with this one, Michael. Let us know.
So we were at the Mall of America with my youngest. No, with both of my sons. And they took me to Lululemon.
That is your first time?
Yes.
Ugh. I mean, I haven't been there a ton because I can't be spending that type of money on clothes, but I love Lululemon. So I wish I had Lululemon money.
They have nice clothes. That's what they said. Before I went in, they were like, no, Dad, brace yourself because the prices in here are going to freak you out. But then I went in there and I surprised them because I said, you know what? I've been learning the last couple of years that buying quality clothes
you get
is
what
not
you pay
necessarily.
For.
Yeah, there's a frugality to it in the sense of like it's a little more upfront.
Agreed.
Yeah, but it's so much better quality, and they last like 10 times as long, and they look better longer. And so I said, you know, I'm seeing that maybe buying pants at Sam's Club is not the best way to go. That you know, you buy a little better quality, and
my oldest looked at me.
My oldest son put his hand on my shoulder and he said, God, I'm so proud of you. You've come so far.
Yeah. Traded in your Kirklands for a pair of Lululemons.
Yeah. Members mark.
Okay. Gotcha.
That's the Sam's Club version of the Kirkland brand. I know that well because Richie and I, we rock some Sam's Club stuff. I can't even lie. I love it, but I have noticed it's lasting me a winter. It's lasting me a summer. Like I have to re-up every season. So
I forgot about Sam's Club.
Well, like we said, I've just gotten into recently, I've gotten a couple of things from that Built, BYLT brand, and they're a little more expensive, but it's really good quality, and they hold up and they look good. So, you know, I feel like we should start getting endorsements for mentioning these companies.
Right.
Because clearly after we talk about it on this podcast, their sales are going to bump
up. Yeah, they're going to be deep in the black after this.
Yeah, they're going to wonder what happened. So.
Guys, I got to give you a heads up. I might be a little cranky today. A little cranky. You've already seen I've been
today?
A little feisty.
Just today.
A little bit more than usual, okay. I'd like to add.
Okay.
All right. Only because I'm trying out this whole fasting situation. Not fasting from everything and not a spiritual fast. Just to try to get healthier fast. So I think, Michael, you've said it. You've done some fasts in the past, or I don't know why I'm rhyming, but I stopped eating at 6 p.m. last night. No, 6:30. And I didn't start eating again until 11 a.m. So like essentially when we started this podcast, and I was like shoveling food because I'm like dying. But I'm like, man, I haven't done a spiritual fast in a while. Yeah. So I'm like, I don't know if I can do it anymore. These fasts are hard. And especially when you don't have, I feel like with spiritual fast, you have kind of a why. And I still have a why because I'm trying to get healthy at the moment. But sometimes it doesn't always help when you're like, there's three cookies right here.
Right.
At least if you have the spiritual portion, you're like, you know, I'm trying to partner with God on this. I'm trying to strengthen my foundation of faith. So it's a little different. But advice. Can you give me some advice?
Well, the most difficult part of fasting for me is not the lack of food. It's that I get cold.
Oh, I have been cold the last few days.
Yeah. It's really miserable. Because you don't have that, what is it, like the hypothermic effect of, you know, your body digesting the food. I think your body temperature drops because your blood sugar probably drops. So like if I'm fasting, I will flat out, it could be summer and I'm wearing a knit hat, I'm wearing a jacket in the house because I'm cold. I think if you're fasting for health, what I've learned is I did do it for a while. I stopped doing it because looking more into it, I realized that there's not any greater benefit to it than simple calorie reduction. But some people find that an easier way to reduce their calories. And so if that works for you, do it. For me, I don't do it anymore for those reasons, like the intermittent fasting and stuff. But it's fine. But that's the miserable part for me is the being cold.
That makes sense. But just want to give everyone a heads up. You do it, Jason.
I was doing it before it was cool to do. I don't know if cool is the right word. It's not really cool. but I do it for I don't know if I have a really slow metabolism or what, but I only eat usually once a day. And so it's basically intermittent fasting, though I wasn't trying to do it, but I lost like 60 pounds doing that within a very short amount of time. And so I've just kind of rolled with it.
Yeah.
It makes it really annoying when you're hanging out with Jason though for a day, because you're like, I'm hungry. You want to go eat? And he's like, I'm not hungry. He's never hungry.
You know, it's hard. Like our staff meetings, we have breakfast together and I don't eat breakfast. And I'm like this total bummer at the table. Like everyone's eating and I'm like, I'm fasting.
Yeah. Well, I just want to give you guys a heads up. I'm a little snappy. All right. That's why. I might have some crazy questions coming your way. I think it'll be good.
I think that'll be exciting. I think it'll help help the episode be more fun.
Well, I'm trying to be a whole new creation by the fast, but that is our topic. Like,
ooh,
segue,
that's a professional segue right there. That was beautiful.
We're staying on topic of what we have been talking about, what you guys have been talking about. I've missed a few episodes. I was happy to be back last episode. What is the focus of this episode's new creation talk, guys? Michael.
Well, I'm actually going to throw it over to Jason. We're going to, I think we want to talk, we want to start with the fall, so-called, of Genesis 3. and go from there. And the beauty is of these episodes is we're just going as far as we go. So I can't really say where we're going to end up today. We have a plan, we have a map, but we're just not restricting, you know, like how far we get. So we're trying not to rush things.
I love it. Just,
yeah, going along the way and having discussions. And if we feel like, because we feel like this is the discussion we had. I'll say this here, if I haven't already said it in this series. We really want to explore new creation, not just theologically, but really practically in every area of life, right? Like this is eventually where we're going this season is what does it mean to be a new creation at work? What does it mean to be new creation, part of new creation in my marriage and in my parenting and, you know, in my neighborhood and in my politics and all of those things. And so we're laying the foundation here, but we kind of want it to be more discussional and exploratory rather than, oh, we've got the map here and we've got it all laid out. Because I just learned over time, it's good to have a plan. But when you come in with like, here's what we're doing for the next X amount of time, and we're going to do this, 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 and this, you're going to get content driven. And it becomes more about content than people and the spirit and what actually needs to be talked about. So we do have an idea, but we're letting the spirit kind of run the flow of the conversation as well. And we'll see how far we get today.
Well, I am very excited because I feel like this topic is one of the most frustrating things for me, being a disciple, being a believer, being a follower, all these things. Is seeing others come to God as well, but not living as a new creation. It is, and I am not trying to prop myself up because I don't get it right all the time either. But I do think there has to be a level of striving to continue to live out being a new creation every day. And so I think it's, where is that, you know, where does that spark start? Where does it happen? Where does it go away? How do we keep it? I think that's like the question, because I know initially we're gung-ho, but it pains me to see people not living out new creation ways on a daily basis or even trying to do it consistently. And I think that's a lot of the downfall. So I'm probably spiraling here. I told you I was feisty today.
No. But you know, I love that, Gianna. And I'm going to say this real quick before we do throw it to Jason. That makes me think of I love the way I heard this. There's another podcaster named Mike Erie. And he was talking kind of in this general direction. And I think he had a listener question or something and he was answering it. But he talked about the difference between striving for outcomes in our spiritual lives and fruit. And that we tend towards, especially in modern America, we tend towards outcomes. Like, here's exactly what I want to, you know, here's what my children are going to look like. My children are going to be baptized and they're going to be this and they're going to be that. And in my career, I'm going to do this and that. And in church, we're going to have this many baptisms and we're going to have, you know, this many new visitors and we're going to reach out to this many people. And the difference between outcomes and fruit, he says, is that we control outcomes. Fruit is something that you pursue an environment, right? Like you can't create fruit. You can just tend the environment and then mm-hmm. the fruit comes up. And yeah. So I think in new creation, that's part of it is we have to get rid of that outcome sort of thinking because it's really an impatient, it's almost self-idolatry without realizing it. It's like, we'll do this stuff. You know, it's for God, but we'll do it. We'll make it happen. Our own effort, our own, you know, that kind of thing, rather than creating an environment for the spirit to grow kindness and goodness and love and mercy in our communities and in our lives. And so I think it helps to frame that at the beginning and say that's kind of the bigger thing we're working here towards is the fruit of new creation rather than outcomes of new creation. But that makes it harder, right? Because we can't then say this is exactly what it's going to look like at the end.
True. That makes sense. Yeah. I think I'm going to get back to you, but I think it's the point of when I'm on social media a lot, when I hear people saying like, I love Jesus, but I'll put my hands on someone or I'll fight this or I'll do this. And I'm like, so we just neglect new creation altogether.
Right.
I don't understand that. So that's why I like the topic, Ron. I'm going to let Jason expound and talk about what you just mentioned. But
well,
that's where I'm coming from today.
Real quick, it reminds me of that song by, I might get his last name wrong, Toby Enigwe. And he has a song like, try Jesus, don't try me, because I throw hands.
That's my point. That is so prevalent in at least the culture that I am around and a part of a lot. And that is why I'm so frustrated, because I see a lot of people deeply hurting and not changing. And it's comments and lines like that in songs and in other people that are portraying that they're believers not living in their new created self. That's what I'm bothered. So
Jason.
Right.
Ooh, that was like jinx. We said that at the same time. Don't we have to like do our little fingers or something now?
No, we're not. You owe me a Coke, but I don't drink Coke. So.
I owe you Coke. You owe that's Coke. What it is.
That's
okay. But Jason, in Jeremiah 4:23, it says, I looked at the earth and it was formless and empty. And the heavens and their light was gone. I looked at the mountains and they were quaking and all the hills swaying. I looked and there were no people. Every bird in the sky had flown. And he goes on from there. I don't want to jump the gun, because if you want to start talking at Genesis 3, we can. But I wanted to read that and say, okay, what is this passage? What's going on? How does this relate to Genesis 1, 2, and 3? Or does it? Or what? You know, kick us off here.
Yeah.
Confuse things?
No, I'm already confused. So that's fine. that's cool. That you brought that, those verses up. You know, you might be able to say that. And I know that this is controversial, or maybe people don't realize that, but like study of the Christian Bible in terms of having like an overarching narrative or like a grand narrative. Some people are suspicious about that you should read the Bible like it has one larger story. That's a cultural issue that people are wrestling with, the notion of story. So setting some of that aside, those discussions, I think we can say that the Bible does tell a story, and it's complicated. And we've said this probably before, but you cannot flatten every text into one train of thought. It's not completely homogeneous, the Bible. Like, there are discussions happening. There are different perspectives on the same issue, which make different points. What I'm trying to say is there is a thread which runs through the Bible. And you could say maybe that thread should be described as creation and new creation, right? It's like, this is the major idea that God is the creator. And there is a movement due to sin, due to evil, from a good creation to a, I don't know, do we want to say compromise? I don't want to say compromise. Maybe that's too strong, but a creation which is going corrupt. In fact, I just looked at this morning in Genesis chapter 6, verse 12. it's almost a direct quotation of Genesis 1, you know, over and over God, it says, you know, like God saw that it was good. And in Genesis 6:12, this is, you know, just getting into the flood story, he says, God saw that it was corrupted. You know, it's a point there. Instead of saying very good, the author switches, and it's the same phrase, but now what God is seeing is a we could say fallen world, I guess is the way we put it, broken,
corrupt. And it says the people of the earth had corrupted their ways.
Oh, right.
Almost like Genesis 1:31 at the end with, yeah.
Yes, right. Yeah, so there's this story because, like, creation goes into a certain amount of turmoil due to rebellion. And even that rebellion is complicated because it's not like humans just on their own decided to flout the command of God, but they were coaxed by the serpent, right? So it's this really challenging, tempting situations humans live in. And we opted for an alternative kind of wisdom rather than God, the wisdom of listening to God. And it thrusts creation into disorder, right? Not just non-order anymore, but like disorder. So one of the standard pictures of judgment in the Bible is an undoing of creation. That, and in Jeremiah specifically, we're dealing with a number of issues, idolatry, which inevitably leads to flouting justice, right? Like a careful attention to religion, but you're not concerned about your neighbor, worshiping false gods. You know, Jeremiah is speaking about this period where Israel's going to go into exile, which is itself a decreation. So he's using this picture. Your lives, what I see from God because of your lives, is the reversal of God's good world that he's created. It's like the undoing. It's almost like a step-by-step dismantling of the order God has made, which is what the flood is about. But this is a standard image that our rejection of God's ways is tantamount to a undoing of the world. And I think the Bible's looking, it doesn't begin with that sin, it begins with creation, but so much of the story focuses on how God brings creation that is good into its, you know, its what he made it for, which is new creation. God has to do something new. So we could talk more about, because it happens over and over, right? This is the last thing I'll say, and we can throw it back to you. But it happens over and over, right? Like after the flood, Noah and his family come walking out of the ark, which is itself a kind of like presence of God. Really interesting stuff. But Noah comes out to this freshly cleansed land, right? You can envision the ground is still wet from the floodwaters going away. And he's described as a new creation. All that creation language is applied to this new phase in the world. Noah is portrayed as a kind of like second attempt. And the problem with Noah, of course, is the same problem we all have if you started with any of us. And that's that we have these propensities towards rebellion. We have this brokenness. You get down the line a little more after more turmoil, and he calls Abram. And it's the same thing. The calling of Abram is couched in kind of creational, you know, that vocation of humanity. It's in those terms. And actually, Bereshit Rabbah, which is a rabbinic commentary on Genesis, the rabbis have God saying something like, I'll make Adam, and if Adam fails, I'll make Abram, or I'll make Abraham. But Abraham is seen as a new creation. So there's this constant attempt amidst the undoing of creation to God, for God to use people. And that's a really important thing. These human created problems, God solves them or answers them by sending human beings. And so that's the thing in Jeremiah. Okay, back to Jeremiah. Yeah, so the world's coming undone, but it need not be the case, right? You could turn back to me. You could get your affairs in order and bring yourself more in line with creation rather than ruin the whole thing. But that's like the story of Scripture. It's not about how to get away. We keep saying that, but it's really important because when we get to Paul, for example, when he says, if anyone is in Christ, new creation, like what you were just talking about, it's not just you got to keep the right rules. It's that you're living in Christ, you're living in a new way of being a human being in a renewed world. And so it's important that we keep the story in the world and don't ever move it up to heaven or something like that.
So that's really interesting. Let me throw this thought at you guys and see if I'm way off base or if this makes sense. So when we were in Minnesota before we moved here to Texas, one of the classes we had tons of different classes and stuff, but there was a period for maybe even a couple of years or something. I don't know if it was that long, but
is this in the church or in your,
yeah,
your
yeah, graduate sorry.
School? Oh, okay,
so gotcha. we would have a Sunday evening Bible class in our home. And we did a bunch of classes, but this one was in our home. It was Sunday evenings and it was smaller-ish. And so we had men and women in there, but there was a group of women, especially, that were really passionate about studying the Bible and learning. And one of them came up to me. We were in Minnesota this past weekend visiting our boys, and we went to church in Minnesota there. And one of them came up and said, you know, I've started this Bible discussion group in my family. And I think they do it online kind of around the country and stuff. And there are a bunch of different traditions, you know, spiritual traditions within that family group. But she said, you know, one of the things we were discussing Habakkuk, which is kind of cool in and of itself.
Yeah.
That's not how a lot of sentences start with. You know, we were studying out Habakkuk.
Yeah, my family. Right. Yeah.
And
most people don't know how to pronounce it. Being one of them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
How would you pronounce it, Gianna?
Habakkuk, like you just said.
Okay.
Well done.
I think there's also Habakkuk and.
Habakkuk, yeah.
Yes.
What is the correct way? What's the correct way? I'm going to go to Jason. I feel like Jason knows it.
Is it like Habakkuk or something
okay,
like that?
Okay, so I mean, yeah, close no enough, one knows.
You know? Now yeah, I'm going to say that,
well,
that
that's
way.
A good point. No one knows. So there you go.
For the rest of probably time, true. I'm saying Habakkuk. Yeah.
I'll find out now. Dang it. All right, keep going.
I don't know. That sounds like a drink or something. I'll order a Habakkuk. So anyways, she comes up to me and says, I kind of noticed this pattern of God challenging Israel almost the same way he challenged empires, but it seems like God keeps issuing the same challenges over and over again throughout the Bible, even in the New Testament. Why is that? Why does he keep saying the same thing? And I said, well, that's interesting. And I thought about it for a minute, and then I went on and explained, and I said, there's this idea of empire, and I talked about some of the things we talked about in Revelation, and that one of the reasons John calls Rome Babylon is because it's kind of this history rhyming, you know, Babylon.
Yeah.
is an archetype where Babylon was Babylon and Egypt was Babylon and Syria was Babylon and Israel at times was Babylon. And now Rome is the new Babylon and there will be future Babylons. And God will always stand up against the injustice of empire and Babylon with the day of the Lord. And he might use another empire to exact the justice of the day of the Lord. And, you know, there's an ultimate day of the Lord, but there's this pattern. And in the same way, as you were talking, what it made me think of, Jason, was there is this pattern in the story of the Bible where God brings creation and justice and order and righteousness. That's what creation is. And then there is this corruption inaugurated by the choice of humans, but also there's an instigation or role of the powers and authorities, the divine, the heavenly realms are involved in instigating and influencing and persuading. And so then humans go the direction of decreation, and then God brings new creation. And so in the same way, in the face of the decreating of creation, God will always offer a new creation. And there's been many new creations, but there is an, you know, there are foretastes, but there's an ultimate new creation that is coming that in one sense has arrived in Christ, just as the day of the Lord arrived in Christ, but it's not the full consummation. So is there, do you see what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Is there a bit of a parallel there of that pattern of, you know, God will, this is what God always does to empire is the day of the Lord. And what he always does to injustice and decreation and chaos and disorder is he creates an avenue for new creation.
Right.
Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. Right. And I like that you point that out, that, you know, or at the end of the biblical epic, right? It's a very carefully crafted description of the restoration of all things, right? And it's gathering up all of these ideas into its full measure, right? Like everything is brought to its, you can't say it's brought to its end, because even that end is almost described as a new beginning, which is really cool to think about. But it's brought, so to speak, online in the best possible way. And that, unfortunately, no matter how much of that hope and new creation has been inaugurated among the people of God, we're not there yet. We still live in a very broken place, a rebellious place. Broken almost puts it too softly, don't you think? We call something broken, it's almost like it happened to us. We had no part in it. But we've created a horrible situation. And so the theme, yeah, you're right.
Vandalized. We live in a vandalized place.
Yeah, right. That's a great way to put it. Yeah. 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 This is why I think if we look back, and I don't know how deep in the weeds we need to get or you want to get, but in chapter 3 of Genesis, we have the story of the serpent. And he's called a beast of the field. And he is one of the creatures over whom the human beings are supposed to, rule. I want to lovingly rule, right? The creatures of the ground. But he, the serpent being crafty, gets human beings to doubt the command of God, which is for the sake of life. And it's really cool when you look at the calling of Abraham. It's, you know, it begins with, go where I will send you. And it's this summons to faithful obedience. I know that's a probably a trigger word for many church folk and beyond, but it's the kind of trust in God that his command is for life. That's still the case when we, you know, when we opt to listen to God, to be loving, to be kind, to do good, to refrain from evil. When we listen to the voice of the Spirit, we are choosing life. And what's really, I think it's involved, but this whole story about the garden with the tree of knowledge of good and bad, the tree of life, it seems to me it's very much a story about learning to trust God. The whole wisdom tradition, in Proverbs 3, wisdom is described as the tree of life or as a tree of life. And in Genesis, trusting God is, you know, the humans know good and bad by learning to trust God. The theme of the wisdom literature, like learning to gain wisdom, learning to have the tree of life, learning God's ways, is to fear the Lord. What does it say? Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And so there's this move within the Bible to get people to see that wisdom is all about learning to trust God, the very thing that Adam and Eve didn't do in the garden. They didn't trust the Lord. They didn't faithfully honor their vocation to be rulers, however you want to put it. So that's encouraging because it shows that there is a way within a fallen world to come back to God, but it always has to do with trust and faithfulness. And the restoration of the world is something humans couldn't do, right? But in Christ, the faithful one, God and the God man, like he carries out an obedience to God, a trust in God that he allows us to participate in through union with him. And so there's so much encouragement in the story of the Bible in that what's needed to prevent the world, to prevent our families, our schools, our businesses, the places where we live from being uncreated and ruined is a trust in God. It's really simple. Like creation moves forward as God desires or gets back online as God desires through simple acts of trust. And that's kind of like the heartbeat of life in the church, right? Is to live this. I guess my point is like obedience and sin both have very cosmic effects. You know, they're both linked to, the unfolding of history, creation itself, our own little stories. I don't know if any of that made sense, but, So I guess, okay. So here's the question I guess I have, living in a new creation, means to live in something that's restored, something that rather than being taken apart because of sin is being put back together. What does life in a new creation look like? I mean, you talked about like the practical piece of this, but I think how does one live in a fallen world, which is simultaneously being renewed? And I think it is practical, but there's not a lot of clarity, I guess. Like so much of it seems to be, not a lot of
examples.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's confusing, right? And there's competing notions within a renewed world of like think of political discourse, you know, like there's competing understandings of what it means to most fully embody this obedience to God, this wisdom of fearing God first, of trusting the Lord. And so it makes it, the church feels like the Bible asserts that we're living in new creation, but this quote unquote new creation still feels very contested. Like it still feels very, like the serpent is still slithering around, is how it feels sometimes, still whispering in our ear.
I feel like that can go back to what I brought up at the very beginning, which was my irritation with what I'm seeing.
Oh, right.
I was going to say disdain, but I think if I were to play the other side, if there's not like clear cut, definitive like words in the Bible or examples now of exactly what new creation is in every situation, in every circumstance, it is very difficult. And so I think that's why I get even more irritated, is like, who knows if my perception or what even I define as new creation is correct. And I'm holding them to my standard of what new creation is. And I'm like, can God just give us a standard? What is new creation, bullet point by bullet point, so that I can just follow it? I can be renewed. Others can be healed. But it's just not that clear. And I think it's just so frustrating. So when I hear you, I hear like, okay, Gianni, you got to have more grace, which I know I struggle with. But it's like, I just want to see healed people renewed and restored back to the state in which God wanted us to be in the beginning. Man, it's rough.
That's so good, Gianna. I have all these different thoughts swirling around in my head, and I don't, of course, have just a, well, Gianna, here's the answer to that, because it's obviously not that simple. But to go back, Jason, to what you were saying, and maybe I'm just restating what you were saying, or maybe this is slightly different.
You probably should, because I felt like I was stumbling around to be clear. So,
well, I'm just trying to grasp in my own mind. So I don't even know if this is summarizing what you were saying. But I think we talked about this in some previous episodes about starting the story in Genesis 1 and 2 versus Genesis 3. And I think when we kind of really in our minds start the story of creation and the Bible in Genesis 3, where everything roots back to Genesis 3, then we start to think of creation as a story of broken rules. God created this thing that worked, and then humans broke it, and now there's a certain way to fix it that we have to do. We have to follow the instructions to fix it back to the way it was. You know, it's kind of like when a kid goes in and messes their room up, and you walk in and say, okay, the toys have to be picked up and put over there. Make sure you put your pencils away, make your bed, you know, and on down the line, whatever it is. And then it's very clear when the room is back to the state of order that you wanted it. And we can tend to then move forward and read the Bible that way. And I think that leads to the sin management mentality, the old creation dynamics of clarity, power, you know, do this, do that, ordering around, hierarchy makes sense. and then we'll get things fixed and success and working and have those outcomes, right? But I don't think the creation story is a story of broken rules, as though God said this, humans disobeyed it, and now it's all messed up. I feel like it's a story of broken relationship.
I was just going to say that.
Right?
That seems better, because it's a rejection of one who everything in the story, and it's funny, when that reminds me, when I'm if I'm trying to help somebody understand the Bible, like, you know, it's maybe their first time introductory Bible study for somebody, teaching them the faith, I often make the point, like, is there anything in the first two chapters of Genesis which suggests this is a God who maybe shouldn't be trusted? And of course, everyone's answer is like, no, he seems to be really enthusiastic about the flourishing of people, and have this large vision that they are also implement his very reign. So there, not only is it a safe thing to trust him, like, you know, like your wildest dreams will come true by trusting him. And so it's really heartbreaking when you see humans capitulate, you know, under the power of the serpent, and reject God. Like, there's something relational about that. It's not just that they rejected some program. This is a very trustworthy God who seems to have plans for their own good in mind. And if you do that to any person, if you reject a person who's laying down their life for you, the greatest transgression is relational, right? Like, yeah, you shouldn't be mean to people. Like, that's bad, but you shouldn't be mean precisely because of the relationship. That's what makes adultery so ugly, right? Like adultery, like, especially for us Christians, if someone cheats on with another person on their spouse, they broke the rule. They broke the command. Like, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't cheat on your spouse. But that's not the problem. They broke the command. The command exists precisely because they harmed the relationship. Like, the relationship is the thing that God is aiming to keep intact. But we tend to do that. We think about very legalistic, like, loophole kind of terms. Like, the problem is I broke the rule. Now God's really mad at me. No, the problem is you ruined the relationship by your behavior. I guess the good news is relationships can be restored, but I think that's an important point to bring out, that if you start in Genesis 3, you lose that. The relationship that's set up, that's being violated, you lose, which again goes back to our discussion last week, which makes sin a lot smaller than it actually is.
Right, which was such a great point last week. And then to build on that, I think when you do that, and move it forward, it becomes like culture war Christianity. Like, okay, there was a set of propositions that were messed up. Now we have to get back to living by those propositions. That'll fix what's wrong. We have to do this and that. And so you don't want to live by those propositions. You are the problem here. You are now part of the enemy. You're over there. We're the good guys. You're the bad guys. And that can result, where if we see the story as broken relationships, that creation is the harmony of relationships. That's what it is, between humans and our environment, humans and animals, animals in the environment, like all of these symbiotic things working together, and behavior which decreates that, which causes disorder and breaking of relationships, is the problem. So to return to that room analogy, If I just tell my kid, you know, hey, you got to clean this up, boom, they clean it up, it's nice and neat and easy. And Jesus, I'm still kind of responding to your question or your thoughts. I think that's the messiness of what new creation is it's a restoration of relationship. That's never easy, right?
It may not look the same, I think. Each relationship restoration looks different dependent on what the harm was or the disorder was.
Totally.
That's a great
point. So let's say a spouse commits adultery. Does it now fix that if they come back and go, I will not ever do that again? I will stop doing that behavior.
Right.
It's not going to work for me. I'll tell you that.
Right. Right. Because there was damage to the relationship. And if they said, well, what do you want me to do to fix it? You couldn't answer that question.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Right.
There is really nothing that just waves that away. Right.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
And also, like I mentioned just a second ago, if it happened to me and it happened to my best friend, we would have two different ways of restoring it if we wanted to stay in the relationship. I know there's been things that have happened in my marriage that have happened in other marriages. And that woman, you know, it maybe took a lot less for her. And for me, it took a lot more for Reggie to grow or change in a certain area. And so it's just like the restoration for one type of topic will still be different for each person's relationship, because that wasn't enough for me. I needed more from him than this other woman needed from her husband. And it is what it is.
Yeah.
But we both still restored.
That's right, so good. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And that speaks to the, if we're going to talk about, what to do piece of the life of faith, that speaks to some of what it means to do the life of faith, is that you're kind of like called to be on your toes. Like not everything is cut and paste. And that's kind of what I hear Michael saying with the living in harmony with creation, is to learn to live in this place wherein, you know, the word right, I suppose, like the word in this discussion, righteousness, doing right, the opposite would be wrongchessness. like
I'm
but
not sure that's the opposite.
Yeah, but like it's learning to live.
Word.
It's learning to live in the right, but that's the way to think about it, right? It's not like some, just at least in most parts of the Bible, it's not just a religious category. It's about living in harmony. It's about doing right. And a really important scripture for Protestants, of course, is Genesis 15:6, where, and this, the grammar is interesting, but it's usually something like, an Abraham trusted God, and it was thought to him or credited to him as righteousness. Like, there's a connection with trusting God and doing the right thing. And that's why I love that the Bible or the gospel gives us the way of the cross rather than cut and paste, like, and same with the garden. It's don't eat from this tree. It's not like don't do this, don't do this, do this. Like the story keeps it very brief, because I think it's trying to establish a baseline, not particulars, but a baseline of learning to trust. When our deepest disposition is one of trust, we'll die because we trust. We'll carry the cross because we trust. And if we're willing to do that and we're paying attention to our environment, we live in faith. Like we're living, or like the, his last example would be the parable of the Good Samaritan. What do I do? Who is my neighbor? And Jesus's answer is everybody. And you got to figure that out, right? Go do likewise. There she is.
Yes. Queen Zariah has joined.
There she is. Yeah.
Join the episode.
Yeah, I have one.
Her little hair is flat from laying on her back.
She's just been sleeping.
Oh,
hi, Zizi. So I've always been told in my Bible studies when I was coming through the ranks, that righteousness or to be righteous, it meant being in right relationship.
Yeah.
Would
well,
that
yeah.
Be a good
there you go.
Definition.
I think so. I mean, for the most part,
like,
yeah.
Where does that come from? Like, sure, tell me that, but why? And is that a good definition of that? Because to me,
yeah, but, I mean, I don't but know. Oh, sorry,
it
go
makes
ahead.
Sense. I just accepted it. Like, yes, that's what it means. But now that you're talking about it, I'm like, okay, we are talking about relationship and right and wrong, this and all that. So I'm just wondering, is that a good definition? Because I'm sure a lot of people have heard that as well within our movement.
Yeah, and I well, that's a very Protestant obsession. You know, like the. Yeah, this it's a real controversial word. especially when it comes to reading it in Paul.
We don't need to get too deep then, my bad.
Yeah, no, so I think the basic idea is doing right. It's not just a theory like, oh, we're good. We're righteous, like we're good. We did the right things and so we're good. I think it's a way of being, which is to do what is right for the sake of the other. But to do that means to improvise, to be an image bearer, so to speak, to be a co-creator, to be a participant, to live on your toes, to do the right thing rather than follow some program. Because there's cases where a good command or a good principle can be applied in the wrong situation and therefore not be good, right? Like sometimes our religion and our desire to have a program can undermine the very good that we're called to do. Like your example of the brother who didn't go to church because he was freeing slaves. he broke the rule for the sake of, and that's, I think, some of what it means is to live in step, which means to live in trust and in awareness, availability.
Yeah. No, that's so. Let me say this. I'll try to say this in 2 minutes if I can, and then I'll be done.
I'm already done. So this is the last word.
All right. Well, G always gets the last word, but
okay.
So it's funny because I'm actually preparing a sermon that I'm giving in a week or two on this topic, and I've been thinking about it. And the passage it took me back to, I actually haven't preached on directly in 8 years. And so I look forward to making this connection in this sermon. But this idea of understanding the story that the Bible is telling, the story of relationship and new creation, but I think it starts to get at the lack of ability we have to really fix the situation.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
The need for trust. And it's the story that's quite famous in Luke 15 that's known as the prodigal son or the lost son. And in that story, this young boy comes to his father, makes a really outrageous demand in the culture, like, I want you to give me my portion of land, which means his father is going to have to sell some of the land, but he's still living on it. So he's going to have to sell it at a cut rate to somebody because he'll still be living on the land until he dies. And this is a super shameful act. It brings shame on him and the whole community. And then the young man goes out and he blows through the money quite quickly. And then he realizes, oh man, this is a problem that I have to fix. I have messed this up. And so he tries to get a job because the only way he can fix things is to restore the money, to give the money back culturally. And so he gets a job, but it's a terrible job and he's only getting paid enough to eat and not even very good at that. So that's not working and a famine happens and then he even loses that and it's just terrible. So then he comes up with his own plan. And there's kind of a translation thing here where the original text says he came to himself and we read that as like he came to his senses. But cultural experts like Kenneth Bailey have pointed out that's not what that figure of speech means. It doesn't mean, oh, he repented and he realized I'm at rock bottom and I have to go back to the Father. He's scheming.
It's calculation, right?
It's a calculation. And Jesus quotes almost directly Pharaoh from the Exodus when he's kind of scheming a plot. And he says, right, I'll go back to my Father and I'll fix this. I'll work as one of his hired hands. And his thinking is, I'll make the money back and I'll make this right. I'll restore what I have decreated and messed up and corrupted here. And so he plans this whole monologue he's going to say. And then as he's making his way back, the father sees him. The father takes the initiative and runs out to him. And Jesus is doing all this to explain his ministry and who he is, who God is, what God is doing through him. And so the father runs out to him, and the young man starts his plan. And he's like, "Father, I've sinned against you." And the father cuts it off. It's like, "You can't fix this. You can't make right what was wrong, but I am going to restore it. I am going to give you the ring and the robe and throw the party and all of that." And so, again, I think it to use that phrase I started at the beginning, I think we want outcomes. We want to be able to fix it. Like, "God, what do we got to do to bring about new creation? Tell me exactly what to do and we'll do it." But it's not a thing that's been messed up. It's a relationship that's been broken. And only God can restore that. And we can create the environment in our lives, in our spiritual community, where God can work and bring about the fruit of new creation, but we can't do it. And that's what's frustrating. And how am I supposed focus on this thought when Zariah is wearing these amazing heart-shaped glasses on each eye and smiling like that?
Smiling like so
crackling. You guys can't even hear. I'm muted, but I messed up the thought.
Oh, no, that was the end of my thought, girl. But it pales in comparison to that cutie.
Unbelievable.
So I am done with that thought. I am done. That doesn't provide the answers. It's more just the direction I'm thinking is that it's God who brings about new creation.
That's a good tee up. Yeah, because I guess it makes sense now. We shouldn't, because we haven't, you know, you kind of have to read the whole Bible to get the whole thing, but it's probably time to like start to look toward the New Testament and see exactly what you said, that God has to intervene to recreate and then to re-employ human beings in this new creation.
And that's where we're going in our next episode.
Yeah.
All right, guys, good stuff. I had some cliffhanging questions, but I'm not going to bring it up. It's too much right now. But
write them down. Write them down, and we'll start there next week. But I can clearly see you have some snuggling to get to.
Yes,
glasses. And that's going to be way better than anything we could talk about right now.
Yes, I will go back to taking care of little ZZ from her nap. Hi, can you say hi? Can you tell everyone, hi, hi?
She'll never do it.
Yeah, she'll never do it. But when we get off.
Kids don't do anything on command.
You know, I think Z is going to be on the podcast one day because she might be a baby genius, we think, at this point. She can already do Psalm 23. Yeah, she's memorized it with Reggie. They do it every night.
Really?
She can count past 10. She knows her ABC. She's not even a year and a half.
That's pretty advanced.
I want to hear her do Psalm 23. That's,
I have to start.
She does it in Hebrew.
The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not. Can you tell them? Look at
the camera.
Yeah, she's just being coy, aren't you? Nice. Okay. Anyways, well, thanks for joining us on another episode talking about new creation. We're all striving to get better in our new selves, and we'll talk more about it next week. But thanks for joining us, and you can reach out to us on Facebook or by email. We'll catch you guys next time.